Okay, welcome. Before we start with our content, before we start continuing the chapter of classification, finishing it up, I want to talk shortly about the submissions. The first submission ended yesterday evening. I guess most of, well, a lot of you did great. We had 16 teams with full points, which is great. However, there have been some technical difficulties. The points weren't displayed correctly early on in the submission. And yesterday I set a wrong deadline. Due to these two things and the submission being a first iteration submission, so these submission sheets have been created for the first time this semester, I decided to lower the points needed to unlock the mock exam from 75% to 60%. So you will need a lower point overall to unlock the mock exam. Because I don't want you to have problems due to technical difficulties or things like that. I think that's a fair change to that. So overall, you will need 60 points over all submissions. Not every submission has to succeed 60%, but in total, you have to reach 60% of points to unlock the mock exam later on in the semester. I will change this percentage in the student course later today once I put in the points of this submission as well. The second submission on the topic of classification will start today. And it will have 50 points. So there are more points to earn in the second submission. So even if you didn't perform well in the first submission, you can still reach unlocking the mock exam. Okay, with that said, we can go back to the chapter of classification and finish it up. If I remember correctly, we stopped quickly explaining significance of t-tests, and didn't yet come to explaining receiver operating characteristics during the last lecture. Is that correct? Because I'm not 100% sure with that. Is anyone of other opinion? Okay, perfect. Then let's start with this very important kind of curve. A ROC curve is very often used to describe the trade-off of balancing out a model's true positive rate and a model's false negative rate, or true negative rate, so false positive rate. Most often, you can, for example, try to find all true classes. You can try to train your model to always find correct true classes. So, for example, I will use the same example as again. If we have a COVID-19 test, we want to try to find everybody who's COVID, to identify everybody who's COVID with our classifier, in this case, a COVID test, to really be sure that nobody that has COVID will get a negative result. So in this case, we try to get a high true positive rate. In some cases, however, we want to focus on getting as low as possible false positive rate. So we try to find a way to never say we are of that class if we aren't of that class. These things are often diametric to each other. So you can either optimize for one or optimize for another. And if you draw the true positive rate and the false positive rate for your specific classifier out on a curve, it might look something like this, a rock curve, where the perfect classifier would have a perfect true positive rate and a perfect false negative, false positive rate. So there are nearly 100% of cases are classified correctly as positive, and none are classified wrongly as positive. However, that's not really realistic to reach in most cases. In most cases, you will be somewhere below that. So if you train your classifier to have a good enough false positive rate, then your true positive rate might not be the best of all possible with that classifier. However, if you decide to go with a worse false positive rate, you can increase the false, the true positive rate. And if you plot out every possible setting for your classifier, you will end up with that, with a curve like that. Your goal with a rock curve, the quality of a model, is often described as the area below that rock curve. So for the blue, we have this area I roughly outscope in here as the area below the rock curve, the blue rock curve, and we try to maximize that. The bigger this area is, the better the quality of the rock of the model is, because the higher our false positive or true positive rate in relation to our false positive rate is. The worst case is, of course, a random classifier, so we just throw a dice to select which class you are of, which hopefully is never reached by a classifier you train, because then your classifier is you shouldn't do that. In most cases, you will lie in between the perfect line and the random classifier line. And then you can, of course, on this line select the fine tuning you want for your specific classification. Very often used to visualize the trade-offs between false positive and true positive rates. Other aspects of model selection are, of course, and we can't measure them with our with the methods we already talked about, and neither with the rock curve, are, of course, speed. We might want to have a fast classifier to be able to decide quickly, which might go for the quality of a classifier, might have a lower area below the rock curve. You might also want to have a robust classifier which can handle noisy data. Not every classifier can handle noisy data. Or missing values, which is something that very often is the case in the real world. You will have missing values. You might want to have a scalable classifier. A decision tree might become big very fast. If you have a lot of classes and a lot of different attributes, a decision tree can become really big, really fast. And there's a point where a decision tree doesn't fit into the RAM of a certain computer. And then you have to scale it to a bigger system. Of course, with a decision tree, you can split certain subtrees onto different systems, and therefore it's scalable, but you have to think about that. And also something very important, interpretability. There might be an argument to be made that a decision tree is easier to interpret than a naive bias. If I simply have numbers which decide which class I am of, it's harder to understand than following a path, a certain path within a decision tree. And it might be better to use a decision tree if you want to explain your bosses how the classification works than to use a naive bias classification. All these things are, of course, also part of a decision of which classifier to use. So either the quality measurements or such things like speed, robustness, scalability, or interpretability. Of course, there are even more than that, but let's finish it up here. Are there any questions regarding the whole subsection of selecting a model based on quality? Okay. Then we can go to the last section, and we will go through that pretty quick, which are ensemble methods. Because once we have measurements to measure the quality of a model, we can also discuss combining different methods, different models into one to increase our accuracy, our area under the error curve, and things like that. These are called ensemble methods, which basically are composite models that consist out of several models to form one big model. We can do that, for example, to combine models with certain weaknesses together to clean up these weaknesses. But we can also combine models of the same type to get to the best result possible. Basically, the idea is to partition our training set into multiple training sets, K training sets, train a classifier of which type you want, to each training set, and then every of these classifiers returns its own prediction, which is then voted on by majority voting in most cases. There are some exceptions to that. For example, you train 5 decision trees on 5 different subsets of your training data set, and then use it on a specific tuple to do a prediction. 3 of the methods say yes, 2 say no, then the overall decision would be yes, majority voting. Nothing special about that, but that's the most often used model. It's shown that these combinations of different models often very much increase the performance of your model. We can also do that with numeric regressions, which are a sub-kind of classifications, where you can predict a float number, a floating number, a continuous number, in which case we would simply average out the results of all classifiers. The most popular methods are begging, boosting, and random forest, and we will take a look at some of them, or all of them even. Let's start with begging. Begging is not bootstrap aggregation, but bootstrap aggregation. There's a T missing after the 2 O's in here. Sorry for that. I will fix that later on. Which is basically the majority voting. So we have multiple doctors or multiple classifiers that take a look at our tuple, are trained on a different subset of tuples, and then everybody, every classifier, in the analogy, every doctor, does a prediction, and then the majority vote wins. Basically what I've explained on the previous slide. With a real number, also what I've explained earlier, we would simply choose the prediction of every model and average it out to select a best thing. This is often significantly better than a single classifier derived from the data set. And it can handle noisy data a little bit better. It's still not perfect, but it can handle it better. Overall, in most cases, not every time, but in most cases, you will improve accuracy with that. Boosting is a similar thing, where we, again, have multiple classifiers. And now we do not only have an equal vote, an equal majority vote, but we have a weighted vote, where every classifier gets a weight that is determined by the previous predictions. So if you have a classifier that always predicts classes very well, we can assign a higher weight to this classifier than a classifier that performs worse in most votes. And therefore, the best classifiers are boosted, therefore boosting, and have more weight within the voting process. But besides that, it's pretty similar to begging. We still vote using every classifier's classification. Every classifier returns its prediction, and then together it's decided which is correct. Very important in boosting, these weights are continuously updated. So every classifier can improve its weight during the process. If we have a truth available. If we know, if we somehow get out the true class, we can retrain that. But pretty similar to begging, besides that, weights. Okay, now let's go to ADA boost, adaptive boosting, which is a special method using boosting. I don't think we have to go through that whole algorithm here in detail, because it's basically just an algorithm for this boosting technique. And explaining also how we can determine weights and things like that. I would ask you to take a look at that at home, and if you have questions, ask for next week, because then we can go on with clustering earlier and probably finish up the whole lecture earlier. So since this is based on the algorithm, I will also skip that. And the last thing is random forest. The last method we are talking about is random forest, which is a method for decision trees, therefore forest, because multiple trees, where every tree is generated not on the whole data set or a subset of tuples, but on a certain subset of attributes. So we only select random attributes to train our decision tree on. Why is that different from selecting tuples? Well, because every attribute might become a node in a decision tree. If not every node is part of our training process, these nodes can become part of our decision tree. And therefore, if we have random selection of attributes in each training phase for different decision tree inductions, we will end up with different decision trees, most likely. And therefore, we might end up, or we will probably end up with a more robust decision tree model if we combine the predicted classes of every decision tree that is part of random forest, of a random forest model. Which, and that's very important, is very, very robust. There are two different variants to that. One is forest RI for random input selection, where we simply select a random subset of attributes of the training data. Forest RC is a little bit different because for this we generate new features for every training phase. For example, by linear combinations, we can also do that basically with PCA because we generate new features out of attributes in PCA. However, more often we have just linear combinations as it's computationally less expensive to do that in that case. In accuracy, it's comparable to AdaBoost, which is the method I asked you to take a look at home. But, and that's very important, it's more robust to errors and outliers. And also with a decision tree, the bigger the set of attributes we train our decision tree on, the more expensive is the training of the decision tree. So by only selecting a subset of attributes, of course, each creation of those decision trees, it is much faster because it's nearly exponentially faster. The last topic I want to talk about, not method, now we are back at topics, is how to handle unbalanced data sets. Because we might have a training data set on cancer. Not a good, a nice topic, but some people get cancer. Of course, luckily, are not that many people with a specific type of cancer. So if we want to train a classifier predicting if a person with certain health attributes might have cancer or not, we have a training data set with a lot of hasn't had that cancer, that type of cancer, and only a very, very small amount of people which are of a class had cancer, this type of cancer. So there's a big imbalance between this yes and this no class. If we simply would use this imbalanced data set, we wouldn't be able to confidently predict the classes. Because first, we might have a training data set, which is a random subset of an original set, which doesn't even include anyone with cancer. But also, if there are 10 people with a certain attribute combination, attribute value combination, that didn't have cancer and only one had cancer, then a decision tree would always put out the class doesn't have cancer. Which is not always what we want. In this case, of course, we want most often to have a high true positive rate because, we don't want to say anyone you don't have cancer and we will not take a look at you in detail if there's a chance that this person might have cancer. In this case, we can, of course, handle unbalanced data as well. One big method is to, with intent, undersample or oversample. So, for example, If we select a similar amount of attributes having cancer and attributes that don't have cancer as our training set. In a normal classification, that would be not what we want. But in this case, it helps us to handle this imbalanced data set. We can also, of course, move a threshold. Say in naive bias, say once the yes class has at least a posteriori probability of, and we lower the amount down to a very low amount. Or we can, of course, train these ensemble methods, and these often perform better with these imbalanced data sets to handle these imbalanced data sets. One thing that has to be said, these are just ideas how to solve things. In the real world, these problems are really hard to solve. You will have to invest a lot of time to solve them. And this is just a cheat sheet on how it might work. Okay, and this is finally the end of the classification chapter, and we can get to the summary. During the lecture, the three lectures on classification, we, of course, talked about what classification is in general. We talked about some detailed methods, decision tree induction, rule-based classification, naive Bayesian classification, and we roughly outlined some more, but these are the most important ones we talked about. We talked about some evaluation matrix, accuracy, sensitivity, specificity, and so on. We talked about k-fold cross-validation or cross-validation in general. We talked about significance tests in some detail and drug curves in some detail. And we talked about some ensemble methods and also the problems of class imbalanced data and how you might be able to solve them. Are there any questions on the topic of classification? On any of these points? Okay. If there are questions, of course, you can always ask in forum. I'm typically very fast in answering them. Then we can go to cluster analysis, or clustering for short, which is our next chapter, which again will take about 2 weeks to finish, 2 lectures to finish. Okay. In cluster analysis, in this whole topic, we will talk about first basic concepts. Again, of course, I have to explain to you what clustering is in general. We will talk about specific methods. And in this lecture, we will talk about 4 types of methods. One type are partitioning methods, like k-means. One are hierarchical methods, like Birch. One are density-based methods, like dbScan. And one are grid-based methods. All these methods have pretty different approaches to clustering. You will have very, very significant differences between them. Much like decision tree induction and naive bias, which are 2 different approaches. Regardless of the methods, we will also talk about how to evaluate, again, how to see which methods are good, or which models are good, perform good, which models perform bad, and we, again, will have a short summary at the end. Let's start with the basic concepts of clustering. One thing to talk about is, of course, a cluster. What is a cluster? A cluster is basically a set, a collection of data objects within a larger set of data objects. And all these data objects that are within one cluster are more similar to each other than to the other objects within the data set. This similarity might define differently depending on your specific task. For example, we would be able to cluster you in here. We can cluster you on similarity of gender. We can cluster you on similarity of degree program. We can cluster you on similarity of grades in past exams. We can cluster you on all three of them, and depending on that, you might end up with different clusters, or you most likely will end up with different clusters. So the definition of similarity, or also dissimilarity, is pretty important for classification, which is something we have to talk about. In class analysis itself, we always have to define these similarities. Because without that, we wouldn't be able to cluster. However, cluster analysis is part as is defined as unsupervised learning, contrary to classification. Classification was supervised learning. Now we are at unsupervised learning. What's the big difference? In classification, we had a ground truth. We could use the real classes to train our classification algorithms, or classification models. In clustering, we try to find things similar to classes, because clusters might also be classes. If I cluster, for example, kinds of sport events, not sport events, of sporting, of things like tennis, football, soccer, things like that, then a cluster might be, a resulting cluster might be sports that are played with a ball and sports that are played without a ball. These might be resulting clusters of a clustering algorithm. They might also be the results of a classification, because we can describe these two classes. So it's pretty similar. It's not always the same, so we have to differentiate between clusters and classes, but they are pretty similar to each other. However, we do not know which classes we will get. Clustering is often used to get insight into data distribution, and I guess everybody of you has at least once seen a result of a cluster analysis and understood it naturally. So I'm not worried about that. And it's also used as a pre-processing step very often. For example, in biology, we use clustering to identify, or we can use it to identify similar types of animals or plants or things like that. In marketing, very often used. We can cluster our customers into different interest groups and say, not only customers who bought this also bought that, that's frequent patterns, but we can also say customers with similar interests like you bought that without having at least one item within your shopping cart. That's often done with clustering. With clustering, we first have to define what is our goal of clustering. Our goal of clustering is to have a high intra-class similarity, so high similarity within the same cluster. Data objects that are within the same cluster should be similar to each other, depending on our similarity definition. While we want to have as low as possible inter-class similarity, so similarity between data objects of two different clusters. Again, it depends a lot on the similarity measurement. Of course, the quality of a clustering method depends a lot on the similarity measure. The implementation of a method, and also the ability to discover some or even all hidden patterns, because that's what we want to detect, hidden patterns. Back to the dissimilarity-similarity metric, because it's very relevant. Typically, we describe this metric as a distance between X and Y. So two data objects, X and Y, and we talk about similarity between these two data objects as the distance between the two data objects. If you go back to my examples on how to cluster you, a distance function might be again, based on grades, let's do that, because it's numeric, it's easier to do. A person with an average grade of 0.5 and a person with an average grade point average with 4.0, of course, have a bigger difference, a distance between each other, than two persons with 1.5 and 1.6, for example. It's pretty easy to understand. And of course, the lower the distance, the higher the similarity. The more likely they should be to become part of the same cluster. These distance functions most often have an interval scaled range, and they can measure distances for interval scaled, Boolean, categorical, ordinal, ratio, and vector variables. So for many kinds of different variables. It doesn't only work with numeric M types. We can also have distance functions for degree programs. I would argue that the distance between data science and mathematics, or let's do IT, is less than the distance between data science and astrology. So there can also be distance measurements like that, which are less easy to understand. We can also have distance measurements that take in account multiple attributes, not only one attribute, because a data object always or most often has more than one attribute. If we have different attributes, we can, of course, weight our different attributes, because maybe some measures are more important than others to determine the significance of this attribute. Something that is something we will talk about later on is, of course, we have always to determine how good a cluster is. Of course, we have this definition, it should be similar in intra class and less similar inter class. However, if we have a similarity metric and we can define different similarity metrics, how do we measure the quality of different similarity metrics within our clustering? That's not as easy, because the similarity metric is by definition how we measure the quality of our clusters. So if we change the similarity metric, we of course will get different results, because we have different things to optimize for. We will have some goodness measurements for this as well, to select a good similarity metric. However, that's part probably of next week's lecture to do that. One thing that is pretty important for me, we are again, and that's probably true for all of our chapters, in a highly case-dependent subject. I can only give you the tools, I can only explain you what you can look for, but you have to find the solution for your specific use case. For a cluster analysis, if we select a method to cluster our data, we of course have to do a pre-selection, because there are many, many methods to do clustering. And this selection can be done based on different criterions. Because different methods not only differ on the quality side of things, but also on the kind of results. For example, we might want a single level clustering. So we just differentiate clusters on a single level. So we just differentiate, let's say, these data points in three clusters. This is single level. But we can also have a multi-level result for specific methods. If we say now, within this cluster, we can have specific subclusters of data. Then we have a high level and a lower fine granular level with even more clustering. Depending on what approach you want, you have to choose specific methods, because not every method is able to do hierarchical partitioning or clustering. We might also have different exclusivities in our clusters. If we have data points like this, a non-exclusive clustering approach might end up with clusters like this, where one data point might become part of multiple clusters. Not all, and to be honest with you, I think the least of them support non-exclusive clusters. The most have exclusive clusters. We might have distance-based or connectivity-based measurements. Very important, connectivity-based often has some distance measurements behind that as well. However, there is a certain different approach to that. We will talk about both of them, distance-based and connectivity-based. We will get back to that differentiation once we understood the methods. I guess it's easier to explain them. And of course, we might have a different set of attributes we can consider for our method. We can consider every attribute, or we can consider only specific subspaces to cluster our attributes. All these things decide or decrease the realm of methods we can use for our clustering. The same is true, of course, for things like scalability. Not all methods work fine on different machines. Some are very good to distribute them around the network. Not all methods are able to work with different types of attributes. Most of them are, to be honest, but some aren't. We might want to have certain constraints taken care of, which is something not every method can support. And of course, as with all KDD methods, there are differences in interpretability and understandability, so how easy it is to understand a result for someone who takes a look at it. There are even more differences between the methods, however, I wouldn't go into detail on them. Some of them might come up later on. We can, of course, have clusters with arbitrary shapes in some don't support that, but we will talk about that later on in the methods. Again, all these selections, just like these criterions, narrow the amount of methods we can choose for our clustering approach. And all these things are things we have to think about before starting to cluster, because otherwise we waste time. Of course, you now don't know any clustering method. At least most of you don't know any clustering methods. So you can't use them yet to select one method based on that. However, the goal of this lecture is to give you the toolkit to be able to select specific methods based on these criteria. Most criterions do not only cross out one method, but they cross out a whole kind of methods. And we have very many kinds of clustering approaches. The four kinds of approaches we will talk about in this lecture are the partitioning approach, the hierarchical approach, the density-based approach, and the grid-based approach. We have four chapters for each of them, or one chapter for each of them. So we will talk about them. Each of these methods differ a lot. If we go back to this one here, to this criterion, of course, prime candidates to do that are hierarchical approaches. Because if we want a hierarchical clustering approach, result, then we might also use a hierarchical clustering approach to do that. With other criterions, it's less obvious to how to select a method. For each of these methods, we will talk about specific samples. For example, in partitioning approaches, we will talk about k-means and even k-mediots, something we will mention as well, and so on. Besides these approaches, there are even more kinds of approaches. For example, model-based approaches, frequent pattern-based approaches, user-guided and constraint-based approaches. So, again, if you have wanted to have constraint-based clustering, you would go probably with constraint-based approaches. Link-based clustering. However, we will not talk about each of them. We will not talk about these kinds of approaches in KDD because there simply is no time to do that within our semester. And even these approaches are not every clustering approach that exists. There are even more kinds, and there's even less time to explain these. So we decided for these four because they are very important approaches. However, you might also see some others in the real world. Just be aware of that. And with that, let's start with one of the four approaches we will talk about. Partitioning methods. And partitioning methods are, with k-means, one of the most often used approaches. A partitioning method is basically working by partitioning our database. So we have a data set of objects with n objects, and this data set is partitioned into k clusters. So if that would be our data set, or these nine data points would be our data set in this original left side picture, then we would have split our data set into three clusters. So nine data points split into three clusters. And the goal is to minimize the sum of the squared distances in this whole cluster. So we have these three clusters with each having multiple points in it. And we simply compute the distance of each point within the cluster, and we try to minimize the distance of them, the squared distance, to be precise. Very important, we have to set a specific k. So we have to already know how many clusters we want to end up with. And we will talk about k-means and k-mediots. K-mediots is also often part of PAM, partitioning around medioids, in the following slides. Let's start with k-means. K-means is a pretty simple algorithm, and it will become part of exercise and also part of the submission on clustering to take a look at k-means. Basically, k-means starts with randomly or without any specific part, so arbitrarily partitioning the data set into k subsets. So maybe let's do another example on that. And I will use dots for my example as data points, because then we can talk about this with the Euclidean distance between data points, which is the easiest way to understand clustering. Of course, you can have other distance measurements between data objects, but this is the simplest to understand. So I will use it in my examples. So let's go with this two-dimensional data example, and we have the Euclidean distance between deciding the similarity of objects. And we say, in this example, hey, k is 2, because we want two clusters. That's something you can decide on. I just decided for 2 for this example. So the first step in k-means would be to select 2 non-empty subsets. This can be done, for example, this way. Again, just randomly chosen by me. I wanted 2 non-empty subsets, and I've chosen to do that. K-means would now, for each of these subsets, partitioning approaches, compute the centroid, a new point which is in the middle of these data points. Since we are in 2 dimensions, we would add up every x value of every of these 5 points, and every every x and every y value, and simply compute the fifth, the average of these. Since I do not have any scale here, I just estimate the middle point. Let's say the middle point is here, roughly. I might be off a little bit, but on the slides we have an example with a real calculated data point. And for this, we have the centroid, of course, directly on the dot, because we only have 1 point. The centroid is directly on this point then. Very important that centroid doesn't have to be an existing data point. It can be outside of that. In the next step, we then reassign. And in this case, we reassign each data point to its nearest centroid. So this is pretty obvious, this is the closest. For these 2, it's also obvious, these are the most closest. For these 2, it's also obvious, this is the nearest, and for this one as well. So our reorganization would be to create a new partition here and a new partition here. The old partitions I didn't delete, but they would be deleted in the real world. Since all there was a change in data points switch partitions, therefore there was a change. So we have to go through a next iteration of this algorithm. We would again calculate the centroids roughly here, of the new partitions, and again check whether we have to reassign points. In this case, I guess every point is already in the partition of its closest centroid, and therefore we do not have to reassign any data objects. And therefore, k-means would come to an end and stop. Which is basically k-means. Let's take a look at a more sophisticated example. So example where we really have the data points calculated correctly. Let's go with this example where we have, I think, 14 data points. And we again have chosen to select k equals 2. So we want to end up with 2 clusters. We would randomly, in this case, up and down, select our first partitions and calculate the centroids of the clusters. The orange point is the calculated centroid of the red points. The blue is the calculated centroid of the black points. Then we would check whether there are data objects that are closer to another centroid or to the centroid of another partition. This is true for this little black point down here. It's closer to the orange centroid than to the blue centroid. So therefore, it would be reassigned. And we would end up with two new partitions. Since the partitions have changed, we would go back to the calculation of centroids, and we would go on until there are no changes. In this case, even if I didn't draw it on the slide, there wouldn't be any changes anymore because the centroids would be stable. Big advantage of k-means is that it's pretty efficient. We have a big O notation of tkn, where n is the number of objects, k is the number of clusters, k-means, and t is the number of iterations. In most cases, t would be much, much slower than the number of objects. It a little bit depends on the first selection of the partition. Of course, if we would select this point, the top right point, as cluster one, the point next to that in partition two, then again, partition one, partition two, partition one, and mix it through in a not very optimized way, we would have to do more iterations than we would have if we select a good first estimate, which is why often these are divided on one axis to have one thing to do. Other methods like PAM, partitioning array around meteors, which is what we will talk about next, has a worse big O notation, and Clara, a method we will not talk about in detail, but it's also a partitioning approach, also has a worse big O notation. So it's very efficient. The big problem of k-means is that it only is possible to do that on objects in a continuous, because we have to calculate the centroids. If we have a categorical cluster, how could we calculate the centroid of whatever degree programs? We can't calculate the centroid of a dimension degree program. That's not possible. We have to have a continuous, in best case, numerical space. And we have to specify the number of clusters beforehand. Otherwise, it wouldn't work as well. There is actually a method, change to that to apply something similar to categorical data, which is k-modes, where we simply select the most often occurring value of the data set. However, I see that less often used. And for k, there are ways to determine the best or at least a good k beforehand, which is something we will also talk about later on in the last chapter. One very big weakness, however, is that it's very sensitive to outliers. If we have k equals 2, and we have one outlier here of data, then it's very likely that this will become one cluster, and all of this will become one cluster, because that's the best way to minimize the distance. And of course, that's not what we want. We do not want to have one cluster for an outlier. And also, K-means is of course not suitable to detect clusters like for example, this wouldn't become a cluster because these would be closer to anything on the right side and so on. This can't be a result of k-means. Whether I want that, that's totally on the other side. However, it's not possible to detect something in the shape of that. There are, of course, different, not variants, I would say, implementations of k-means. They often vary on the selection of the initial k-subsets, because you can save a lot of computational effort with selecting a good initial k-subset, k-subsets. You will have differences on the dissimilarity calculations. We used Euclidean distance. However, you can, of course, use a lot of different distance measurements to do that. And also, they're different on calculation of cluster centroids. It's easy for numerical values, that we can simply calculate mean for each dimension, and that's our centroid. However, that's not possible for every data kind type. It's just possible for numerical data sets. So you will have different strategies for other data types. We already talked about k-modes, where we have modes instead of centroids to handle categorical data. I'm not really liking that because there are methods that are more suitable for categorical data than k-means or k-modes in this case, in my opinion, but it's an option to do that. We already said that k-means is sensitive to outliers. There is a variant that is suitable, however, more computational expensive, which is k-medioids. The big difference is, like with k-modes, that we select another point to represent the cluster. We are not calculating a centroid, but we are calculating a medioid. A medioid is simply the most middle point of the given data points. So we do not create a new point, but we select an existing point as representing data point in k-medioids. For example, the point where the distances to all other is the lowest, which is most often the medioid. For example, for these two clusters, orange and not clusters, partitions, in this at this time, they aren't clusters, they are partitions. We would select the red point and the blue point to represent the big blue point to represent our cluster, our partitions. And then we would again recalculate the distances to the medioids, to the given medioids, reassign, and so on. Until we are at a stable point. The problem is to find these medioids, these representative objects in the clusters, and there are different methods for that as well. One specific method is PAM, partitioning around medioids, which starts from an initial set of k medioids, so we select not clusters, or not partitions, from the beginning, but we start k-medioids. So we start with middle points. And then we first assign the points closest to these medioids, the lowest distance to these medioids, to our cluster. And then we go on from that for the algorithm. PAM is very efficient for small data sets, but has problems with large data sets. There are variants of PAM that try to solve that problem, for example, Clara and Clara NAS, Clara NS, which try to solve that with sampling. So we only train our method on a smaller sample and therefore have a smaller data set, which is again better for PAM. Why is that? That it only works efficiently for smaller data sets because of our complexity of our big O notation, that is more is worse with PAM than with k-means. Okay, let's take a look at PAM for an example as well. We have a data set where we first choose a k. Let's do k2 again. Now we do not select initial subsets, but we select initial medioids. And then we reassign every data point to its nearest medioid. And then we now, if we would now recalculate the medioids, it would be harder. So we do a similar thing where we select a random non-medioid point within that cluster. So for example, for the right cluster in here, we select the red point down here. And we now check if we would make that the medioid, the representative point, whether the quality of our data set has improved. So if we reassign now all data points to this new medioid, whether the total distance within our clusters, the overall distance within our clusters is lower than before, because we try to minimize the total distance again. And that's done until we have, again, no change, similar to k-means. Very important, we of course always have to compute the improvement of cost. Only if there's an improvement with the change will stay. Let's take a look at certain cases. Let's say we have OJ, so this brown point. And it belongs to the medioid of I, the left green point. Now we try out to replace I with H. So we have a new medioid, or we try out a new medioid for our cluster. Now we can calculate the improvement of distance through that change, at least for the data point J, by calculating the distance between I and J and the distance between I and H, J and H. This might be a small improvement. We have to do that for all points within our cluster, and if overall we have a lower distance, then we might make H to the new data point. And because H would still be the closest medioid, T is far away from J, J would of course stay within the same cluster. It wouldn't change cluster. A different case is if J is the brown point in the upper left corner, and we change I to H, then of course distance might change between I and H. However, since J is part of a T cluster, and it will stay part of a T cluster because it's the closest medioid, there wouldn't be any change in overall distance. If J belongs to OI and OI is replaced with OH, then we have to again take a look at this. Because now it seems like J is closer to T than to the new middle point H. So in this case, we have to reassign J to the new cluster and therefore have to recalculate the overall distance, because the distance might be a different for that. And if we replace again I with H, then it might also happen that the medioid switches cluster and we are closer to T now and are therefore again in a new cluster. And we have to recalculate these things. We have to do that for every single point, which is of course not that inexpensive. It's more expensive than k-means because we have to calculate a lot of possible combinations. And if there's a small improvement, the new medioid will become the new new cluster giver or the cluster leader or things like that. Which is very expensive for larger data sets because we have to calculate a lot of combinations, possible combinations within the data set. Something we can't do with larger data sets, even on modern computers. We already mentioned there are methods to improve that, for example, by Clara, clustering large applications, which draws samples, multiple samples from a data set and trains PEM on each sample and then middles out with the best point, comparable to bagging in classification. And this, of course, can handle larger data sets because multiple smaller data sets are better with PEM than one big data set, because we have this exponentially increase of complexity. Very big problem, it depends on the sample size and it depends on the samples themselves, how good this is. It can further improve by randomized Clara, which draws dynamical random samples for each step of a search. Now we are not training a whole PAM algorithm on one subset, but we draw one subsample for each step. If we find a local optimum, we start with a new randomly selected node and so on. It's more efficient, more scalable than both PAM and Clara. However, of course, it's still not perfect. We might end up with a less optimal result than with PEM, but faster, basically. K-means is, in my opinion, one of the most important clustering methods. K-means is very often used. PEM is not that often used, but it's also part of a lot of big libraries. So you will find PEM within a lot of different libraries. The k-means you find within a lot of libraries is often optimized, so it's not pure arbitrary first partitioning, but it's stratified first partitioning. We have a better selection of a first subset within these implementations, but that's something you do not have to worry about because it's better for you. One important part is that you will or you might end up with different clusters depending on your first partitioning. So if you re-implement k-means, for example, during the submission, and try to verify it with stratified, already implemented method from whatever library, you will probably end up with different results, which is not a problem. Both results might be valid, but it can happen depending on your first data selection that you will end up with different points. That's just something you have to have in mind so you are not worried that your implementation is wrong, or even two different two different libraries might end up as different results with different results because there are multiple correct results for clustering. Correct results, but of course they might have different goodness to results. Let's go to hierarchical methods, because these are methods we will not take a look in such detail, but in some detail, I guess we can make that true today. Hierarchical methods are, of course, methods like I described early on the left side of the lower blackboard, where we have different layers of clusters. We have one layer at one end where every data object is part of one big cluster. And we have another extreme on the other end where every data object is in its own cluster. Of course, both of these are not really relevant for our clustering, because what is gained by having everything in the same cluster or everything in its own cluster. More interesting are the steps in between, where we have clusters smaller than this big cluster, but bigger than every data object has its own cluster. There are two different kinds of hierarchical cluster approaches. We might start with the smallest clusters and just combine them together to bigger clusters. This is, for example, done by Agnes, and it's called agglomerative clustering. So we combine different clusters together and end up with bigger clusters by combining them. The opposite of that is divisive clustering, where we start with all data objects within one cluster and splitting it up into different clusters. One big example for that is Diana to do that. For Agnes, so the agglomerative nesting, so combining together smaller clusters, we are talking about a method by Kaufmann et al. Nothing you have to know for the exam. I won't ask who invented Agnes. Don't worry about that. That's just an additional information. The single link method is used. We will talk about that shortly. But basically, we merge nodes that have the least dissimilarity between the nodes. And the dissimilarity on the nodes is defined by the single link method, but later on. And you go down, or you go on, until you end up with all values within the same cluster, because then you can't join anything. So basically, you start on the lowest layer, add Visto up, for example, because they might be the closest, have the smallest distance than E, and so on, until you are up here. This kind of diagram is often used for that. That's a dendrogram. I guess it's pretty self-explanatory. If there are questions how these dendrograms work, you can ask me later on. The other method is, again, Diana. Again, first introduced by Kaufman et al. It's basically the inverse order to Agnes. And it terminates once every cluster, every data point has its own cluster. For both methods, we have to define the distance between clusters. Because we said within Agnes, we combine the clusters together that have the lowest distance between both. One pretty simple method is the minimum distance. We simply take a look at the data points of each cluster that are closest together. So if we have these two clusters, then we would compare, we would define the distance between the clusters as the distance between the two closest points of these clusters. The same can, of course, be done as maximum distance. Then we would compare the distance between the two most distant things. We can define it as the average distance. We can define it as a mean distance, which is a small difference, because we would use the centroids, and we would. So basically, what I've drawn here is more of a mean distance than this average distance. In one case, we would calculate every distance and draw the average, and one time we would first calculate the centroids and then draw the distance between the centroids. All these methods are pretty simple and easy to understand. But there are also more advanced things to do. Which is, for example, the nearest neighbor clustering algorithm. In this case, we have distance measurements, and in this case, we have algorithms using these distances and modifying them slightly. And maybe that's the better differentiation. And the nearest neighbor clustering method uses minimum distance, pretty simple. The single linkage algorithm, again, Agnes and Diana, takes a look at the distances of the nearest clusters, and if two clusters are too far away from each other, then it simply says, hey, they aren't linked. So we can have another thing. And the minimal spanning tree algorithm is, which takes a look at nodes in a tree. And it's basically pretty similar to density-based clustering, or not density-based clustering, but dbScan. Which is something, a method we will take a look at next time. So maybe we'll take a look at this second time here, or we will talk about that once we talk about dbScan, which is basically drawing a graph between nodes and, we will take a look at that later on. The farthest neighbor clustering algorithm is basically the different, the opposite of the nearest neighbor clustering algorithm, which uses maximum distance, and the complete linkage is again a graph, and therefore, something we'll take later. A major weakness of this agglomerative clustering method, so Agnes, for example, is that we only go up, we never go down, so we never split. if we merge together two less optimal things, we might end up with a less optimal result. There are methods to integrate hierarchical and, as I said, distance-based measure clustering methods, which we will talk about next week, which combine them both and therefore use spanning tree algorithms to do that. These are Birch and Chameleon. These are more complicated, and I don't think I should speed up and finish them up today. I tried to do that, but I think we should go in here and talk about Birch next week, and also a little bit about Chameleon. However, the focus of our lecture will be Birch. Okay, so let's stop here at Birch. Please remember me that we have been on slide 43 next time. We end this lecture today. Are there any questions regarding today's lecture? Okay. Then reminder, the second submission starts today. Again, 2 weeks till Sunday in 2 weeks. Again, 5 minutes before midnight is the deadline. Hopefully it will stay this time, correct this time, but yeah. And there are still enough points to get to unlock the mock exam, even if you had 0 points this time. So even then, you should try to do it. Okay, have a nice time, have a nice week, and see you again next week on Monday.